business community loves Dr. France Cronier, and rarely have we seen one of our conversations get less than, well, almost 100,000 views. So we are pretty sure with the discussion we have today, it's going to be a lot of interest. He is going to talk to us about, of course, the recent US election, but also events at home. France, lovely to be with you as always. Do you, on US election, presidential election night, stay up all night to watch the results?
No, I didn't. The first Trump one, because it was so close, I did. But not the others and not this one.
Did you have a feeling then, or did your analysis say to you, like R.W. Johnson published, that Trump was going to win because of a number of factors?
By miles, he was going to win. I've got a SRF colleague, Gabriel Macon, who you've actually met in London because he's based there. And well, several months out from the election, what Gabriel was doing is he was taking American data and he was assigning electoral college votes accordingly. And he was telling me the results. And we published, published three reports on the American election. And Trump was winning by miles. So what Gabriel eventually did, just because it was such a significant lead, is anywhere with a margin of error, where Trump's win in a state was within the margin of error of the server, he gave that state to either Biden and later to Kamala Harris. And even then, Trump was winning by significant margins. So we were pretty confident Trump was set to win from the get-go and by some way. A second thing we saw that corroborated that was a very interesting chart that indexed retail spending in America over the past several years. And what that chart showed is that for elite, graduate-educated, kind of coastal, very wealthy Americans, their retail spend had outstripped the rate of increase of, let's say, ordinary working Americans by a multiple of I think, two or three times over the past couple of years. And that, we thought, was very important too. And we also read against that inflation data for the U.S. And inflation data meant that Reagan's famous question is, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? So we saw that, and we'd also seen something else coming. You know, in his first run, Trump got 8% of the black votes in America. In his second run, he got 13%. This time around, he got 20%. So I don't think this was a very difficult election to call at all, except that if you watched mainstream traditional media, you would have thought, firstly, Trump was going to lose, and then you would have thought that it was very close. And I don't think it was that at all. But if you started watching more of the alternative, and you know, I'm an enormous fan of this alternative media, well, what you do so very well, why I'm always doing my best to be here. If you watch that stuff instead, you would have had a far more accurate sense of what the final result in America ultimately was.
How did titles like The Economist get it so wrong, and many of the pollsters as well? The Economist, right up until the end, was saying that it thought that Kamala Harris would win, and indeed it said that the risks of another Trump presidency were far too high. And hence they even endorsed Kamala Harris. But their poll, which was very, very deep and well-researched, apparently, got it so wrong.
It's kind of been. I mean, the numbers were unambiguous. If you looked at the cross-section of American data, which is always pretty good, in calling the result in terms of the Electoral College, you might be a bit off in terms of the absolute vote numbers, but those in America don't matter very much. But the Electoral College far ahead, and even on the vote numbers, if you know the American days are well historically, you could see what the lead was going to be. And for people who read that stuff well, even the popular vote, you know, this was the first popular vote win for Republicans since 2004. And before that was 1988. I don't know why. I mean, I can't speak for The Economist. I don't know why they got it wrong. But I know a little bit about some other American media, and they simply lied to their readers because they didn't like the result. They wanted a Harris win. They disliked Mr. Trump, which is fine. You can dislike it. And I think they just lie to their readership and their viewership. And that's the reason. But that's not my comment on The Economist. I don't know why they got it wrong. But on many of the others, I'm very confident in saying they just lie to the people who watch and subscribe and listen to the news media that they produce.
Sure. Elon Musk and his role, we hear today that he is going to indeed be appointed as the co-head of the government or the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, like his DOGE coin in the alternative to Bitcoin. Is he really going to have the time to do the kind of work that public want him to do?
I'm very sure he will. I mean, you get this kind of stuff sometimes you see it sometimes even in the South African media. Oh, Mr. Musk can't get to everything. No one should be running so many companies and the like. This is a very exceptional person. And I imagine that exceptionalism will feed through into whatever he does inside the US government.
He must have seen what you saw because he bet very heavily on Donald Trump. And it's a bet that came off. But when we look ahead to a Trump presidency for America, we're going to talk about South Africa in a moment. I've got some useful insights there too. But for America, what are you seeing?
You know, Trump beat two parties in this election. That's the way we're starting to think about it. He beat the Democrats and Biden and Harris. But he also beat the Republicans in the sense of the old neocon order of the kind of Reagan-type era. And his comments recently on Mike Pompeo and Nikki Haley. Mike Pompeo had been Secretary of State first time around, and Haley had been at the UN. She was very good there, and very good on South Africa. That they will not have places in his government is a step away from that old neocon order, and I think he's beaten that side as well. So if you calm down about Trump and not be hysterical that the world has ended, you can actually see some very interesting things. So one of those is that he beat the Democrats and he beat the Republicans, and he's building it, and perhaps his kids have some influence there as well. He's building a new something new. If you want to read about it, we don't have to go into too much detail here. Post-liberalism in America. Go read what the post-liberals say. They say the neocons are naive, that free trade simply gives advantages to your enemies, that free speech simply empowers your ideological critics to eventually overthrow you, that proper conservatives, using the word in the proper sense, are naive, that they shouldn't be averse to the use of state power to build a political empire. And that's very different to the old American conservative view, free trade, free speech, and small government, and keep the government out of people's lives. So I think the most interesting thing to watch under this new administration in America is the extent to which post-liberal ideas take root within the country and what the implications of that are for America.
And what are those ideas?
Well, that you should, the old conservative order, it's small government, free trade, free speech, keep the state out of people's lives. The post-liberal order, as I understand, is that, as I said, that is naive of the conservatives. You shouldn't be averse to the use of state power. You shouldn't be averse to the use of state power to force a moral order across society. You should be deeply skeptical of free trade. We'll get to trade in America, which we've got some interesting numbers on that, and also for South Africa. You should be deeply skeptical. You shouldn't have a knee-jerk endorsement of free trade just off the bat. You should read the extent to which you are undermining your own competitiveness and advantaging your ideological allies. So it's a much more stated. It's not very different to a lot of the left in some respects. And that's an intentional exaggeration on my part, that when you win political power, you shouldn't be afraid to use that power through the state to reinforce the ideas, order, and the sort of societal order that aligns with your political values.
Sure. Well, that's going to be, it's going to have many implications.
You see, first that's, of all, a from sea South- change. Mm. That's a sea change of it's complete. And this is why if you just stop the silly hysteria about Trump and actually start to think about and explore it, it becomes very interesting. It becomes a very interesting question of what this kind of America is going to become, what it will one day look like. Can the neocons return? Can the American liberals, the left liberals, can they stage a fight back after such a crippling defeat? I don't know if you're able to put a map on our little chats, but if you can, I'm going to send you one. Okay. It's an amazing chart. It is the election result in America by county, so not by state. And the counties won by Democrats are blue and by Republicans are red. And it's a red map, except for little blue dots, the cities. And what Trump has done, the way, I mean, when we got hold of that, we thought, wow, here we're seeing something, is the Democrats in America govern over, let's call them city states now, San Francisco, New York, and Republicans are governing America, as it were, outside of that. And I would, if it's possible, put it up on the screen, let people have a look at it. It is an astonishing picture of just how overwhelming, in a certain respect, the Republican victory in this election was.
Johann Rupert appears to be playing a bigger role now, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this. We have it on very strong authority that he met with Trump at Mar-a-Lago, alongside Ernie Els, our great golfer, and Rurik Goebel, who's a friend of both Els and Johann Rupert. And the report back that we had was that it was a fairly lengthy meeting, and Johann spoke about AGOA, and Trump listened. The word was respectfully, and they appeared to actually have some common purpose. And then, subsequent to that, there was a 15-minute phone call, which Johann Rupert apparently organized for Cyril Ramaphosa to talk to Trump. This is after Trump was elected, of course, in both instances. This is an interesting development from a person who loves to keep a low profile but has a huge vested interest in South Africa's future. What do you make of that, assuming that our sources are accurate?
Yeah, no, I'm not entirely sure. Talk about the people necessarily, but a few points. One, AGOA is not very important. And there's an AGOA obsession, we'll cancel AGOA. It doesn't present any real leverage to America. I think it is 2% of South Africa's exports now. And a lot of that is auto, and you can make a very good argument that the auto industry is bad for South Africa and causes poverty and desperation, because it prevents the import of the cheap used vehicles from abroad that poorer South Africans need to buy if they want to have the mobility to become successful young entrepreneurs. So I'd say on balance, South Africa's auto industry is a blight upon the country and sustains poverty and inequality and could be done away en masse. I know it's a sort of jewel in the industrial crown for the ANC because and DGI, because without it, there's not a lot else. But so there's auto, and then there's some fruit and vegetables and the like that are important. I'm not saying the Go is entirely unimportant. Just say don't exaggerate. Go look at the chart. Goa, all South Africa's exports to America, exports under Goa. You'd think, yeah, wow, what's this all about? More important, I think, than a Goa, but of course related to it, is the South Africa Review Act, which is inside the U.S. Congress. And that demands of the administration to report to Congress, so it's simplified a bit, whether South Africa is a national security threat to the United States. That's a hell of a thing to ask. The reason that's asked is because there are Americans who know that South Africa is such a threat to the United States, particularly in fronting Iranian global strategy and saying, well, that's part of the Palestinian cause. It's not that. Iran is not a historical ANC position. My somewhat informed sense of this is that Americans across the aisle, political Americans, are not worried about the ANC's historical position on the Palestinians or its concern at the suffering of Gaza. That's accepted. That's an ANC position. The ANC is entitled to that position. But when that position is used as a stalking horse for advancing Iranian objectives, such as the delegitimization of Israel through that ICJ case, then a very different line has been crossed. That is the thing to watch. Now, look at some of the Trump appointments. Elise Stefanik goes to the UN as ambassador. She has, the quote, expressed disgust at some of South Africa's behavior vis the ICJ and Iran, and has described it as anti-Semitic and otherwise. And I think that's an informed sense. Going to NSA, National Security Advisor, Michael Waltz. Waltz was a key driver of the act that I have just mentioned to you. And you know, one of the little jokes going around is that South Africa was about the only thing that united the bipartisan divide in America through the Biden era. This was one thing Congress could agree on. What's that? The behavior of sale of South African foreign policy, so many dangers. Then at State Department, Secretary of State is Marco Rubio. And Rubio also on the record, very harsh on South Africa, most recently about its instruction that the Taiwanese should shut their Pretoria office and move to Johannesburg, which is obviously an intentional humiliation. So AGOA is important. I'm just making the point that it's not all that. If it went away, the South Africans would be fine. So the Americans actually have less leverage there than they realize. But I think they know that. I think what another joke during the rounds is we hope the South Africans never find out that AGOA is actually not terribly important. But the question of South Africa threatening the national security interests of the U.S., that is important. And on that single point turns the nature of the relationship between the two sides initially in this new Trump administration and South Africa's new GNU administration. And if the South Africans back off on that stuff, then I don't think they will have a particularly difficult time in dealing with the U.S. But what I have little doubt of is that if they continue to take the chances that they have, they will not meet with the same indulgence of what they've encountered under past American administrations, and particularly under the most recent administration of Mr. Biden.
And the implications of that, given that even Helen Ziller reckons that the Iranians bailed the ANC out, and she was on the record with our colleague Linda van Tilburg on that this week. And as a result of that, well, when you're indebted to the Iranians as the ANC, you might not have the option of being able to dial it down.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one of the Trump, I think, will do bring an end to the conflict in the Middle East and an end to the conflict in Europe. So I think he's quite good for that. And the one of the little Middle Eastern flags is that Qatar is telling Hamas to find accommodation elsewhere. If you are afraid of the Iranians, which some people in the ANC undoubtedly are, this is an American administration that may carry a much bigger stick and make you far more scared of that. And this is a return to deterrence. Trump around the world, this is a return to deterrence. About 30 years ago, 40 years ago, the Cold War ends, the Soviet Union collapses, the Berlin Wall comes down, and for many Western thinkers, this became what was known as the end of history, because the last serious threat to the Western liberal order had receded. And Western liberal ideas would now inevitably spread around the world, and the need for deterrence to back up diplomacy would fall away. Except that this wasn't the end of history, and it wasn't the end of the last threat to the final threat to the Western liberal order. But a number of Western thinkers, diplomats, politicians who grew up in that end of history period are not accustomed to or uncomfortable with the use of real deterrence. And this, from early emerging nascent post-liberal thing, whatever it is going to reintroduce deterrence, and the ANC is going to decide who it is most afraid of. That said, there's a broader equation around the country and its relationship with the US that I think there are people in Washington who will take very seriously. This is the idea I've been articulating a few times in recent weeks. Draw a triangle. It starts at the Solomon Islands, that's off the east coast of Australia. They had an election earlier this year. They're deeper and deeper into the Chinese orbit. Draw a line all the way across Djibouti, to Djibouti, where the PLA has a naval facility. The Westerners also have naval facilities there, but the point is now China does too. Draw your line down to Simonstown, the very important naval base that the British so regretted having given up after the Simonstown Agreement expired, and a few years later they had to invade the Falklands. Couldn't use Simonstown, so had to use Ascension, which was quite inadequate. And draw a line back from Simonstown to the Solomon Islands. Now you have a triangle. Your triangle includes the South Pacific, the Indian Ocean Rim, and the gateway to the South Atlantic. It's one of the most important geostrategic concepts in the world today. Dead in the middle of that triangle is another island, much in the news recently, Diego Garcia, part of the Chago chain that Keir Starmer madly has just given to Mauritius. And in the Chago chain is this Diego Garcia, which is a U.S. naval a military facility, and it houses in one form or another nuclear weapons and the ability to deploy these. And it's what some people, I think some Chinese strategists, find it very amusing. An unsinkable aircraft carrier in the middle of the island. So China is getting the upper hand on the Solomon Islands, which the Imperial Japanese understood after they had done such damage to the Americans in December of 1941 at Pearl Harbor, was essential to cut Australia off from the protection of Hawaii. In Djibouti, there is this presence and even attempted to expand it through the Mediterranean. Chago has now fallen out of Western hands. I mean, Westerners deny this, but it's plainly apparent that that is the evolution. The last little dot in this triangle with its unsinkable aircraft carrier in the middle is the naval base at Simonstown. If that falls to in the sense that it becomes an anti-Western facility, the triangle is locked in. The geostrategic balance from the South Pacific to the South Atlantic shifts profoundly. And South Africa, therefore not for the reasons of AGOA is linked to, is strategically very important, because slip into the South Atlantic and operate there with impunity, the next stop is and then the North Atlantic, but beyond it, you the next stop is the east coast of the United States, South America.
The geopolitics and the implications of what you've just unpacked for us and did a month ago and was very well understood, I think, by the business community are so important. But what is the deterrent that the United States can give to South Africa? Because clearly it seems as though the ANC has got a Trump hand or a very strong hand in having Simonstown that the US would not want to give up. So what would this transactional president, as we always hear he is, Donald Trump, what would he be putting on the table to say, don't let that go?
Well, the spectrum is immense of options. One of those is the straight up comment of, do you wish to be, as now speaking to the ANC, do you wish to be a Chinese and Russian proxy state? Do you think that will be good? And there's a fallback position now if Simonstown is lost, as I understand. If you go north of South Africa, if you're watching from abroad, north of South Africa, you go through Namibia, get into Angola. Angola is a very large country, potentially very wealthy. And you can cut Angola into three bands. The bottom band is anchored by the Namib port. And the top band is anchored by the port at Luanda. The middle band of Angola is anchored by the port at Lobito. There's a project called the Lobito Corridor. And the purpose of the Lobito Corridor is to build a logistics and commons chain that run from that port. And I went to look at it this year, an amazing, amazing place. Build a railway link through Angola, so imagine the map, through Angola, take a detour through Zambia's copper mines, given the importance of that substance now, and end on the Indian Ocean in Tanzania. And what you've done is that even if South Africa falls to become a proxy state of your Western adversary, you have a fallback position that allows you to secure influence around the between the Indian Ocean and the South Atlantic. So the bargaining position of the South Africans is not as strong, given the libido, as what my earlier explanation, second time for your viewers, of this triangle is. That's option number one. Option number two, I mean, I'm just setting out the myriad of things, is that the ANC has historically done very well politically during its staid and moderate years. In the first 15 years after 94, it takes investment levels up to where, as a share of GDP, so fixed investment to GDP, where they're almost rivaling the global north. Economic growth is averaging 5% by the end of that first 15 years. The ANC's doubled the number of people with jobs. I've said this 100 times in your show. And in 2004, at that election, the ANC 6 percentage points stronger than it had been in 94. When the ANC enters its radical phase, where it's trying to nationalize healthcare or the mining charter, you remember that a terrible document, nearly fatal, the mining industry that still languish under its consequences, expropriation without compensation, ANC support collapses. If the pragmatists within the ANC wish to run a successful, high-growth, liberal democratic society, they can, I'm sure, count on enormous support from the new administration, from any American administration, but particularly from that coming now under Mr. Trump. More so for the fact that it will tend to step back on what I call the cultural evangelism, the Western moralizing towards Africa, the what I thought disgraceful comment was of some Germans who were recently in South Africa, who said that they were being very patient with South Africa, not turning off its coal-fired power. Now that statement is made in the face of a reality where you have 15 million black South Africans unemployed, with no prospect of ever improving their lives if we do not develop an efficient sort of electrical grid. And then you come from Europe and stand here and lecture. And I mentioned to some ANC people, and they shrugged and sort of didn't do much. And the DA is halfway down this rabbit hole of this greenery, which as a consequence will condemn 15 or 20 million black South Africans to a perpetual future of poverty. The only person who seems sort of animated about these things is the sort of Gaten McKenzie, who, to his very great credit, immediately sees the problem. And I actually put it to him that if he were foreign minister, you should find these Germans, escort them to the airport, put them on an aircraft, send them back to wherever they came from, and told them they can return to South Africa when they are able to show some respect for the country and what it is. So the offer that America can make to whoever runs South Africa, the ANC to a very large extent, is that we have the resources, given your tiny economy, a fraction of a percentage point of global GDP, weak exchange. We have the ability to make you very, very successful, not by doling out AIDS medication to ill Africans, which is another subject we can talk about, but through, as you say, transactionally providing the trade, the support, the fixed investment, etc., to make you highly, highly successful. But that if you do not wish to take advantage of that, Lobito, and not even just Jennifer, as far as Lobito, Namibia is looking great. A press freedom ranking, when I last looked, that was better than Canada's. An offshore oil find that might be the largest such find in all of history. A small population, no radicalism, and an electoral position in which SWAPO seems perhaps vulnerable to what has happened in Mozambique, Botswana. Well, Mozambique, politically volatile. Botswana, change of administration. The winds of change, Alec, blowing across southern Africa.
Aren't they fascinating? We are just looking at the South African situation, and thank you for that segue from the U.S. and what the new president is likely to do on a global stage, and then looking at our little country of 0.35% of global GDP. The government of national unity, France, is often in the headlights. It does appear to be paramount in many people's minds that this will be maintained. I suppose in the same way as many give attention to AGOA, and you've explained why it's not really that important in relative terms. But what about the government of national unity, in particular this issue that we're seeing over the Bella Bill, which is something that runs very deep in those who are keeping the ANC in power at the moment, or at least some of them?
Point one, the GNU is the greatest, and we're very, very fortunate that we achieved that result 100 and something days ago. Because if we hadn't at that moment, had it been its extreme alternative, ANC, MK, EFF, the consequences would have been, I think, more severe than many people could easily believe. The currency could have moved very far away from anything that anyone who watches such things would think possible. We could finally have jettisoned the last of the pragmatists on fiscal management in the ANC, the minister and his treasury colleagues, be printing money, creating all sorts of inflation. You then get this American foreign policy lineup under Trump. We'd have been in horrible trouble. So that, it's great. And what a great achievement for the people who put it together. Second point, which doesn't contradict the first one, is I don't know if it will survive. Our conclusion of what we call, in fact, in a note this morning, painstaking interviews over many weeks, is that opposition, even resentment towards the GNU within the ANC is significant. Outside of what we call the cabinet clique, the little comfortable circle, cabinet ministers. Also significant, just sticking with the ANC, is that the anti-GNU rebels in Gauteng have held up. And more than that, they have made ground in deposing the DA mayor of Tshwane and replacing him with the EFF-MK ANC coalition, Herman Mashaba coalition as well. That's important. Third view on the ANC is that Mr. Ramaphosa seems more animated about the G20 and his chairmanship of that, which is pending, and the horizon that presents to his political career than he is with domestic matters here. And we therefore don't think that the ANC will do much to, or go to great lengths to strengthen the GNU where it comes under pressure. Now, on the DA side, we think there's a similar phenomenon. Outside of the cabinet clique, there are concerns. And we think those concerns can now grow. And there are further concerns that whereas some cabinet ministers have been very successful, others have not. And in Indie Mense Praat, which is an Afrikaans sort of way of saying people are starting to talk, that there's a serious problem in the caliber of decisions and policies that are being advocated in some DA portfolios. So on both sides, there's pressures and the honeymoon period is over, let's say that. To the explicit question of if you don't like it, why don't you break it up? Neither side has said, and I mean, they might not have told us, but I don't think, Sada said they're not prepared to pull the trigger on this. And I think one of the reasons for that is that the GNU is very popular with ordinary people. We polled it, or SRF polled it, which is me in some regards, at 100 days, and strong majorities of South African voters thought the GNU was a great idea, very pleased that it hadn't been the MK-EFF deal. 60% thought the ANC was doing well in the GNU, only 25% thought it was doing badly. The DA had equally positive reviews. And as much as it's tough inside the GNU, I don't think either side wants the blame for breaking up one thing that South Africans have become united in believing in. And that they supported shouldn't come as a surprise, because even before the election, the data SRF produced was unambiguous that South Africans were very, very positive about the idea of the DA and the ANC getting together and governing together. The DA, though, and quite rightly, says that it's not simply going to be pushed around by the ANC, and it will take a stand in favor of what it believes is important for its support. So the honeymoon's over. The cabinet cliques become isolated from their parties. Resistance builds. The ANC doesn't go to great lengths to patch up flashpoints. The DA won't back off from confronting flashpoints where their interests are threatened. And in the little note that we just happened to send this morning, we said, we don't think this thing's going to break up in the next 12 months because no one's prepared to break it up. It'll be an unhappy marriage. But looking ahead to 2026, the local government elections, these parties will compete with each other again. And 2027, the ANC leadership election, these could be inflection points at which the GNU is, in South Africa's case, undone. And don't despair and think we almost made it and we did it. This, I think, is going to be part of the country's process. The preference in the ANC, as we understand it, is if it breaks up, not to have any you in the with the G, but to have a minority government to make piecemeal deals with whoever's willing to strike them with you or whatever matter happens to be before Parliament on the day in question. That's a bit shambolic, but it's working. It's tied into the U, the unity part of it. And you've seen the niggle there a lot of that. Some say it's a coalition. The ANC denies it's a coalition. Obviously, it is a coalition. But after that, in 2029, we go to vote again. Public opinion in South Africa remains very moderate. The trend line that where the ANC goes radical and economic performance suffers as a consequence, it sheds significant amounts of support that will still be present. Mr. Ramaphosa will likely not be present. We don't know who will succeed, where the ANC will go with it. So you might have this initial GNU absolutely rescued us, becomes an unhappy marriage now, tension. No one has the boldness to break it down because they know the public likes it. Maybe it eventually fractures. 2029, South Africa votes again. And if public opinion has remained moderate, the opportunity will be to build on the foundation created to create some kind of new GNU of sorts, and see if that one can hold together. So I think, if and I'm very much out on the limb because this is 3 years from now, but I think that maybe this is the chain of events that South Africa will live through. In the interim, of course, the sentiment on the country slides a little bit. You'll see the consequences in fundamentals. And we, 10 days ago, said to people, start to look at your rand bets and whether you want to unwind them. Some advice to you, depends who you are. Very much depends who you are. But well, what has the currency done in the last month? 4.5%, 5%? No. So, yeah.
Well, we're back above 18 to the US dollar, and we were heading for 16. So that kind of puts it in perspective.
And appreciating you held together. And more than that, we were headed for 16. Absolutely right. We could have gotten there. And more than that, we're very confident in what we saw in ANC support, that if the ANC had beaten the rebels in Gauteng, brought the GNU to Gauteng, worked together effectively, secured some sort of modest economic recovery, the ANC would again have been above 50% of the vote by this time in 2025. They would get back to where they were. But because there's this tension now, this conflict, and the rebels have survived, the prospects of that are in question again.
Franz, you know a lot of things that happened behind the scenes. In the past week, we've had Eskom saying to the Johannesburg metro that it's going to cut its electricity off in mid-December. Could this be something that is a card being played by the national ANC against the local ANC, or am I reading too much into that?
I don't know. Look, Eskom's got very good management in place now. So, I mean, just from trying to run Eskom successfully, you've got to put pressure on these municipalities. If there's more to it than that, I do not know.
But on the other end, you do have a shareholder in national government at Eskom who you would have to engage with, one would think, before you cut off the water of the biggest city or the most biggest and richest city in the country.
Look, I don't know.
Electricity, rather.
I don't know, so don't read anything into what I'm about to say. But there is obviously frustration amongst serious ANC people. So you're historically ANC, you come from that background, you might have been very successful in whatever you did. There's immense frustration at the weakness of the leadership at the top of the ANC and that it cannot take this rebel faction to task. And there's an understanding, I think, in that serious grouping that the ANC does do well in eras of pragmatism. It's an understanding that extends as far as saying, what are we doing with Iran? This is not our historic ally. I mean, Palestinians, absolutely, 100%. But this is dangerous, and it's nuts to be taunting the U.S. to a point that you were able to unite the Congress under President Biden. I mean, no one else achieved that. So you were that bad. That's how serious the some of the South African actions have been, and so. And the frustration is that the leadership of the ANC will not act firmly to counter the threat to that party's survival. This is a leadership that might go along with my comment you a minute ago, that if the ANC is shrewd and pragmatic and sticks in the GNU and get some basic reforms right, and we have a truly neutral foreign policy, the ANC can go back above 50% again. So I do not know. You've asked me a question, a very serious question, but I do know that there are very serious people who are maddened by the fact that there's nothing they can do to get the ANC to get its ass in gear to save itself. So what leverage they might have, who knows how they might employ it. But that's, I'm not saying there's what you're saying is right or wrong. I'm saying again, I do not know.
The truth always does come out. Matthew Sposa has written a autobiography in which he fingers the Libyans. And it was always suspected that there was a lot of Libyan money that came into South Africa and supported the ANC. Now an insider says it has been the case. How seriously do we take this belief? Again, expressed by Helen Ziller, as I mentioned earlier, that Iran bailed out the bankrupt ANC, and as a consequence, it's the paymaster, and it needs to be that debt needs to be settled in certain ways that we have seen already, but perhaps more to come.
You know, as far as that's a linear statement, the direct action and the consequence, I'd dial that back a little bit, but the sentiment you take very, very seriously. There is a history of trading foreign policy for cash. The delayed recognition of China, cash from Taiwan. Suharto in Indonesia for cloaking him in the credibility of South Africa's transition. The Nigerian strongman, Abacha, same thing. The Libya, very much the same thing. The order of whatever the you win, and we'll go to bat for you at the UN. That stuff is rock solid. There is a long history of, we talk about the transactional Trump presidency, of transactional South African foreign policy, where money was accepted in order to take a certain a view, and that is very, very, very soft. And this,
but for those of us outside of the political insiders, when you see the latest approach, talking of transactional views, by Ukraine saying, okay, Mr. Trump, if you support us against Russia, we will let you take your troops back from Europe, and we'll be putting Ukrainian troops in the areas where American troops are in Europe, and so on. If you do this kind of thing, we will give you back. From a South African perspective, if our country does have a record of transactional politics, as you've laid out, surely that would be a cause for some optimism. I mean, cynically speaking, of course, but some optimism that into the future, those two parties might just find each other, i.e. South Africa and the US.
Well, our transactional, we mean by that is more suitcases of cash transaction. On this, actually, and on this Ukraine, wait, it's one area of ANC foreign policy that I'm very sympathetic to. Whatever else is going on behind the scenes, just on the points of fact, that NATO's expansion east of Germany continued, even where it shouldn't have. There's a buildup of Ukrainian regulars on the frontier with in the east of Ukraine. Russia was very concerned that this was preempting an attempt to cut across and cut off the Crimea and the port at Sevastopol. The Russian invasion, as it's called, the march on Kiev, was simply to draw those Ukrainians back to defend the capital, which is why Putin didn't take it. And as soon as that happened, the Russian movement into the east happens, and that two sides fight each other very much to the old Minsk Accord lines, which is always the deal that should have been struck. It's my understanding that Henry Kissinger, before he died, was also of this view. So on Ukraine and Russia, what I've articulated to you is how a sort of learned ANC sort of eminence Greece might explain the conflict to you. And I think there's a lot of merit. It's worth hearing them out. You won't hear it again in the mainstream media here. It's not the sort of thing one writes in mainstream media anymore. Just like you don't write that Trump's going to win the election, even though it's plainly apparent that that's going to happen. So I think that's it. And just on that too, I think the concern, and it's my impression, the concern in Washington with South Africa is very much Iranian. The messing around with the Russians is less important. China is everywhere. You've got to deal with China. So how can you think the South Africans won't deal with the Chinese? But this ICJ type stuff, the Iranian ties to that, that's the key concern. And so if you want to, you get past the Goa, you get on the national security question, does South Africa threaten the US? I think you can take that even a step further to say, resolve this Iranian problem. And I think the prospects to get on reasonably well with, and then even profit handsomely from the Trump administration. If we learn as a country, and this is also important, if we learn as a country to trade our strategic position in the world, it's perhaps the most valuable asset that we have that we don't use at all to any significance. To develop a foreign policy doctrine for the country that thinks in terms of that triangle or something similar and says to the great powers, we command the third dot in that triangle. It's the gateway to the South Atlantic. Something goes wrong in Suez or Panama, all global bulk shipping moves between the 50th and 60th parallels pass South. We are a country that values human rights and will say the right things, that there's terrible suffering in Gaza, that the war in Ukraine is a terrible loss of lives of thousands of young men sent to their slaughter by people in politics, a line that you could quote from the Trump team in this election, pretty much. But if you in the West and the great powers want to murder each other in your hundreds of thousands, it's terrible, but we can't do much about it. But we are here and we have geostrategic importance and we're prepared to trade that. We're not a colony that you can mess around. We at the same time understand we shouldn't be messing your national security interests around. We will cease to do that. But here we are, and what can you offer us in terms of trade, in terms of energy, in terms of nuclear power builds? And then if the Russians offer the South African GNU, as long as it holds, a better bet on energy and the building of nuclear, the correct decision for the South African government is to take the Russian offer and to build a Russian nuclear fleet across the country, because that is what's needed to position this and any future South African government that follows from it in such a way that it can create within a generation the jobs to mop up those 15 or 20 million unemployed young people. That is a moral imperative. And if Russia can help us, I just stress Russia now, just to make the point. I sound terribly pro-Western, and I suppose in many respects I am, but also pragmatic. Likewise, if our Western trade partners do not like the fact that we are willing to accept a Russian nuclear deal, they can make a better deal. And a good place to start would be to stop threatening South African exports by saying that because in the Western world we have driven ourselves mad with the new green ideology, we've driven ourselves so mad that we will even come to you and tell you that you better believe in our green ideology, because if you don't, we will punish you. That is how nuts American and European African doctrine has become. And use the great strategic asset South Africa has as this third dot in the triangle to secure enormous advantages, economic advantages for ordinary South Africans so that we can create a high-growth South African economy.
Dr. Frans Grenier is the chairman of the Social Research Foundation and a political and economic consultant and analyst. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.